Well, it was a real honor to be invited to come here. I was sitting with some of my students, postdocs actually now, and one of them I think was trying to scare me. And I said, you know, there's like 450 people registered. And I was like, yeah, whatever. It's not the number. It's the brain power in the room that scares me. And the idea that Dan Bonet thinks I'm smart is quite flattering. And I'm really privileged to be here with a group of people that I consider incredibly smart and also genuinely interested in learning from reality, very empirically minded and interested in looking at how things work on the ground, which is sometimes something that is lacking both in law and in policy circles. As much as you might like to think it translates there, that isn't always the case. So I want to give a talk today that's based on some work I've been doing with Fred Schneider, who's in computer science at Cornell. My guess is many of you know him far better than you know me. And it's entitled right now, Toward a New Legal Framework for Cybersecurity. And as you probably know, cybersecurity is a hot topic. You can ask me at the end of the presentation what it means. I'm happy to talk to you about that. I'll tell you what I think people in DC think cybersecurity means. And so this is going to be the structure of the talk. I'm going to give you a little bit of a brief background. I'm going to talk about why I think a public health-inspired model is an appropriate place to be looking for thinking about legal and policy tools for moving towards better cybersecurity practices. I'm going to talk about some specific features of what this new model might look like, some example interventions, why the shifted legal framework is necessary. I'm actually going to do this first. This slide got out of order. Particularly the insufficiency of current law and why it's timely. And then part of the reason that I'm here is that I think what happens next and whether or not we get more of the same old or we get something better in part depends upon the extent to which this community wants to engage. I was at the EVT WOAT conference the past 2 days because one of the areas in which I've done work is electronic voting, and we had Representative Holt from New Jersey came to speak to us, and he really was lamenting the demise of OTA, the Office of Technology Assessment, which some of you in the room are old enough to know what it was and what it did, but it was the advisory branch of Congress that actually gave them information and did real work to kind of help inform them when they were making choices about whether to regulate technology and what kind of interventions might be appropriate. And it's one of those things that disappeared during the Gingrich Revolution, the contract with America. They had to cut something that was part of Congress, and that's what they cut. And it was really a huge loss because that was one of the places where we could look for good information about science and technology policy, and it's now absent. Okay. So, background. People like to say, right, if you build it, they will come. You build a database, somebody's going to try to hack into it. You build a pool, a kid's going to try to fall into it. But the fact of the matter is, that's not always the story. There's been numerous reports at this point on computer security that have basically said that security in the marketplace is remarkably below what best known practices could provide. Right? So that we have these technological solutions out there, but on their own, they don't seem to improve security, and that what we lack in many instances is not the technical know-how, and in many instances, the practical know-how, right? We understand some of the policies and procedures that need to be put in place. We have some of the technical tools, yet they don't get deployed. And so what we have in many instances is a lack of will rather than a lack of tools. You're much more familiar with some of the advances in science that we have right now available, some of which have been deployed in the marketplace with some regularity, some of which really lay not necessarily wasting on the shelves, but are relatively under-deployed. And I put up just a few. Type-safe programming languages were mentioned this morning. I haven't heard a lot of talk about diversity, but certainly the creation of artificial diversity or even inherent diversity, depending on how we split the marketplace up. We heard some talk about automatic updating tools, certainly virtualization and sandboxing. These are all things that, if more routinely deployed, could certainly advance the state of cybersecurity, computer security, information security, take your pick. Yet we know that there's a lack of will in the marketplace to deploy these things. So often when we find that we have a need and it's not being met by the market, we look to law and policy as kind of a primary tool for intervention. Law and policy, what we do is we try to recalibrate incentives. We use it to deter, we use it to promote, we use it to kind of shape more subtly the motivations that people might have to pursue different policies. When we look at law today, and if we look at all the reports that have come out, and I don't know how closely you all follow the reports that come out about what we should do next on cybersecurity, one of the things that you'll see is that people lament the lack of will. They then mention law, and they say, law, let's not look at that, right? And they set it aside. Often they set it aside because they say law moves too slowly, regulations are too coarse, regulations reify the marketplace, they can't be forward-looking, they move like molasses, not at technology speed. So there's lots of reasons why law is rejected out of hand. But it's always particular kinds of law that are rejected out of hand. Nobody's tried to pull apart and look at the rich set of tools that law actually provides and how they're used to address market failures in other areas, and to think about whether or not those map on to some of the failures that we have in cybersecurity. So what does current law look like? Current law focuses on deterrence, right? So deterrence, I think you all understand what deterrence is generally, but in classic criminology, we have kind of rational choice theory. It represents this theoretical basis for deterrence, and that's the orientation we find in cybersecurity. Under this paradigm, people choose to commit crime after weighing the costs and benefits of their criminal activity, and therefore, if we're going to deter it, we have to increase the perceived costs of criminal behavior. And we often augment perceived costs through a host of different kinds of policies. Generally, they aim at either increasing the celerity, the severity, or the certainty of punishment for criminal activity. If you look at battles over things like copyright infringement on the internet, or if you look at cybersecurity laws or computer security laws, you'll see all of these things, right? If you think about the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which many of you in the computer science community are familiar with, we have this expedited system for removing information that is supposedly infringing even before we figure out whether or not it is infringing, right? So it speeds up the process of getting caught and having an action taken. Computer security laws, particularly after September 11th, the penalties were increased dramatically for unauthorized access, a term that's actually left to the marketplace, right? I get to determine what's unauthorized access of my machine. As a business, and what we saw is a ratcheting up of penalties. So if you look at, internationally, if you look at requirements for data retention, which are proliferating, let's say we have to maintain the connection data between a phone number and an IP address, right? That's about creating the possibility that we're going to be able to do better forensics and therefore increase the likelihood that people are gonna get caught. So we see this increase in celerity, in severity, and in the likelihood of getting caught. It's aimed at two different kinds of deterrence. One is general deterrence, right? And general deterrence is we want to raise the general thought that people are going to get caught, and therefore we want high-profile cases, and those are going to deter everybody. More specific deterrence is when we get you, we're going to punish you really badly, so you're not going to do this again. Now, if you look at cybersecurity law, this is the area that we see the most the greatest number of laws on the books and the greatest focus. Everybody wants to give the police more money. We want to give law enforcement agencies, we want to give intelligence agencies stronger tools to monitor and investigate. And it's not that this is necessarily wrong. It's just that it makes a set of assumptions about criminals that may or may not be so accurate and about our ability to pursue them. One is this idea that they're rational actors, right? And in some instances, cyber criminals may be, but in some instances, they may be people with no choices. They may also be people who are very difficult to identify. We know this to be a case. They may be people who don't live in this country and therefore tend to be outside the reach of our law. So there are a bunch of practical, on-the-ground issues that mean that pursuing this deterrent strategy, at least on its own, doesn't seem like a winner if we want to end up with greater, if we want to increase the security of our systems by deterrence alone. Cybersecurity law also has tended to be driven by what a colleague of mine, Paul Ohm, has dubbed the super user, right? So the cyber criminal who can beat all, who can do all, who's a real general public menace. And he's driven cyber law, and so it becomes more sensationalized, the penalties get stiffer, and we end up focusing on these uber criminals, which are certainly part of our insecurity, but I would argue it has crowded out some more common sense approaches that we might take to make cyberspace a more secure space. And it certainly has not reflected any of the empirical insights or the theoretical insights that have come from the research community about the sources of insecurity. Okay, another area where we currently have law that is aimed at improving cybersecurity is in the area of standards. And I'm going to talk about standards just very briefly. And I'm going to use one specific example because for me, it was a real learning experience about the limits of standards with respect to security. I mentioned that I've done some work on electronic voting, and electronic voting is actually a place where we have their quote-unquote voluntary standards, but there are standards that have been set that are supposed to include security standards. That are supposed to be met if you want your election technology to be used in federal elections. So these standards are not at all aimed at actually doing something that you as a computer security expert would view as looking at how the system behaves under unanticipated circumstances. When a dynamic adversary, possibly with inside information, tries to compromise the system, right? These are kind of functional checklist standards. Do you have encryption? Yes. Well, it turns out you were using encryption, but you had the key embedded in the code. Not so good, right? And so that the standards itself were these functional standards, and then the testing process by which we went through trying to evaluate whether or not these standards were met didn't include performance testing, didn't include penetration testing, didn't include, as far as we could tell, threat modeling, right? So that both the standards, and to date, we don't have a whole lot of faith that we can set substantive standards. I think you probably would all agree. There are some concerns about reifying existing technology. We don't want to be overly deterministic. We have yet to figure out whether or not there is a given set of procedural standards that will give us a certain outcome, right, as in more secure software. We're certainly making developments. There's been a lot of developments in that area. I missed the other invited talk this morning, but clearly there's been some greater kind of cohesion coming out of the security community where we begin to think that we have certain processes that need to be in place, and that's also beginning to be reflected in law. In the context of health information, in the context of financial information, we have laws that require companies to have processes in place, right, to try to improve their security. So we don't tell them to use a particular technology, we don't tell them exactly what they need to do, but we say you have to manifest attention, reasonable security processes, as some measure that you are paying attention to these issues. But we still don't have a lot of faith that any set of standards are going to produce a certain level of security. So there are limitations to this approach as well. Okay. So if we look at the law and we say current law is not addressing the cybersecurity issues that we see today, right? It's going after the bad guys. It's setting standards, and in the security community, we don't necessarily think that standards are going, these sorts of substantive or procedural standards are going to best move us in the direction of more secure systems. We have to begin to look at the problem space a little bit more carefully, at least if, as a lawyer, right? I say, okay, we have a problem, we have this technology, we have some processes out there, they're not being deployed in the marketplace, focusing on the criminals and deterring the bad actors isn't sufficient. Are there mechanisms that we could use to try to incentivize the good guys, right, to do a better job? And so for me, that began an examination of other areas where we have what are called public good problems. Or problems of the commons. Dan mentioned the security breach notification laws, and I was an advisor to then Representative Joe Simitian, now Senator Simitian, who passed the very first security breach notification law in California. And the impetus for that law was environmental law, right? There was an environmental law that was passed in the 80s after the Bhopal disaster where a chemical plant blew up and killed many people. And it was this idea that you could regulate behavior through forced information disclosure, right? And in that context, what it did was it set thresholds above which, if you were a company and you admitted into the land or the air or the water or some other form, the environment generally, some kind of toxic chemical over a certain threshold, you had to inform the federal government, right, the EPA, and that information became available to the public, to the local community, to the government, to regulators, et cetera. It didn't tell you how to go about how what technologies you needed to do you needed to use to go about reducing your emissions, right? So it didn't set any form of standard. It didn't even create any new form of liability, right, for exceeding those thresholds. But merely by requiring companies to report when they had breaches of this sort, what happened was we saw the greatest reduction of emissions that we'd seen to date, far greater than anything that had been achieved through what we call kind of command and control regulations that say you must do X, you must use this technology, you must put this filter on your smokestack. And the reason was that people manage what they measure, right? There was a form of competition among companies, because now you were being benchmarked against your peers. Why is that coal company able to reduce its emissions and you can't? Community groups were able to put political pressure on operators within their community. Legislatures and regulators were able to identify who were the greatest polluters, who were the people who were really a problem, so we could more directly target resources. So in thinking about the security of personal information, for example, one of the things that is very striking is that when a company loses my information, they might not lose anything at all, right? Because they still have it, right? It's not a rivalrous resource. Somebody else might have copied it, but they still have it. They might still be able to exploit it. They might not have lost any of the benefit that they had in my personal information because they were going to use it to market to me, and they can still market to me. It just turns out that somebody else now has it, and that person might use it to get a credit card in my name, but do you know what? The only person that affects is me and maybe the credit card company, not the entity that lost the information to begin with. So there, of course, might have less than perfect incentives to protect that information because the loss of the information actually poses an externality, right? They don't bear the full cost of the loss of the information. So by creating this requirement to notify you, the individual whose data was lost, we could force the company, because they don't want the bad press, they don't want to bear the burden of notification, to actually internalize all of those costs that in the past they'd been able to externalize. Right? So this is a really lightweight regulatory intervention. It had an enormous effect. I've done interviews with chief information security officers and chief privacy officers and a bunch of Fortune 500 companies. And when you talk to them about which laws and to what extent law shapes their risk management, this is one of the only laws they mention, right? And part of it was that it was an attention-getting thing. All of a sudden, particularly if you're a chief privacy officer, you're spending a lot more time with the board and the CEOs because this creates something that has to be reported probably to the SEC, something that shareholders are going to see in the press, something that your competitors and your partners are going to see. And people also think it's some indication if you're not doing security very well and there's information leaking out, maybe your intellectual property is leaking out. Maybe the rest of your business processes really stink, right? So it creates this general dis-ease that actually has some effect sometimes on the bottom line of the stock price, but more importantly on how your customers perceive you, how your business partners perceive you. And therefore what we saw is a huge uptake in encryption, because to the extent that the personal information that was breached was encrypted, you didn't have to report. And companies, and also in the nonprofit sector, I work at the University of California, Berkeley, which has experienced some breaches of its own. And I can tell you what it did was it forced the university to say, do we need to have this personal information? Does this individual need to have the personal information? Can we pull it back? Can we delete it? Can we get rid of? Can we truncate the social security number? So this whole activity in information management, all from this really narrow legal intervention that had no penalties, right? There were no penalties associated with this new law. So as the environmental analogy, it was a useful one. However, we didn't, my colleague Fred and I began to play around with and think about the problem space of cybersecurity, it was not necessarily the most natural one. And so we began to look more critically and fully at the policy options. Now I want to talk about the problem space. So I mentioned the problems of the commons. So what are the problems of the commons? We have, when we're dealing with the commons, it's a shared resource. Choices that you make affect my health, for example, right? So whether or not you vaccinate your child, whether or not I vaccinate my child, if we're talking about communicable diseases, these all have an impact on public health. Classic examples of a commons are a physical land common where we all might choose to allow our cows to graze, and we're each doing something that is in our own self-interest. We add one more cow to the pasture, but at the end of the day, we end up trampling all the grass, and now all of us are SOL because there's no grass left, right? And so we're all acting in our own individually rational behavior, but we're using up this public good in a way that means none of us can benefit from it at the end. In the context of other aspects of the problem that are particularly important in thinking about what kind of regulatory intervention you might want to use, we have constantly evolving threats, right? If we think about, again, public health, I would, of course, ideally like to be perfectly immune to all disease, right? I wish they could find the shot or the pill that I could take to make me perfectly immune, and therefore then we wouldn't have to worry about the fact that we shake hands all day and we breathe on each other, right? We'd all be just our own little island as we walked around and bumped into each other. But we can't perfect the human artifact. And as it turns out, we've had a really hard time perfecting the computer code, that this has not been an attainable goal. We have information gaps. Vulnerabilities are often hidden. I don't know that you're sick. You don't know that I'm sick. I don't know that your machine's infected. It's not obvious to me when I'm choosing to send you email, or even when I get an email from you. I might not be able to tell from that mail whether or not it's carrying some payload that's merely a picture of your kid, or some payload that's going to do some executable code on my machine. We have other sorts of information gaps. I mentioned the environmental context where we have this pollution that goes into the air, and we have some sense that this particular amount of this toxic chemical has this sort of effect on the human population. Often, with respect to security vulnerabilities, what the effect of that vulnerability is going to be depends upon an adversary. And we often don't know who that adversary is going to be. And once they get the information or once they hack into the system, we don't necessarily know what they're going to do with it. And therefore, figuring out what the risk is of any vulnerability is really complicated, because there's a whole bunch of information that we don't know and we're not going to know until after the act has happened. As those of you who are in computer security in the business area know, it's really, really difficult to prove that any particular investment stopped any particular attack, right? So it's very difficult to prove that what you did made sure that something bad didn't happen. Maybe you just got lucky and they didn't attack your system. And so while you can certainly look at losses and think about ways that you might prevent those in the future, it's very, very difficult to say that any particular investment yielded any particular benefit going forward. openness, exchange, and interaction. You know, the internet at this point, we use it for business, we use it for our social life, we use it for politics, and we want information to be able to flow. We've greatly benefited from the ability of different formats, of different applications being able to run, etc. And so there's a high value put on openness, exchange, and interaction. And this is very similar to the society we live in today, right? Certainly our exposure to viruses has increased as airplane flight has become more regular, and as barriers, everything from the mountains to the water, have become easier for us to transgress. And all of that exposure, right, we have, I would say, an increasingly free and open society in certain parts where we've had cross-cultural exchanges. We know certainly each of us benefits from the ability to travel, and there are great benefits here, but those benefits also come with risk. There are also these really complex value trade-offs. In the context of public health, we often have interventions. They could be forced vaccines, they could be forced treatment, they could be denying you a vaccine because the public health worker needs it more. Right, so making these very complicated trade-offs that might affect your bodily integrity, they might impact your business, right? We're gonna regulate your business to make sure that you have certain health and safety standards. We may actually close down your business because we think there's an E. coli outbreak and we think it's tied to your business, but we're not sure. We're going to be able to come in. We're going to be able to investigate. All of these things involve really complicated trade-offs between liberty and property interests of the individual and the collective needs of society to be safe. And in the area of cybersecurity, I think we're facing some of those same challenges. How much control do we want each individual to have over their own machine and the applications running on it and whether they update or not, and you know whether or not they have their firewall or use SSL, and how much of an externality do their choices push out on other people with respect to security risks, or are they fully a little self-contained island? And finally, the value of prevention in the public health area. There's a huge impetus put on prevention over deterrence, and in part, that's due to the kind of problem, right? Often disease doesn't actually have an intent. That's changed somewhat with weaponized anthrax and other sorts of weaponized pathogens and the concerns around those. But in many ways, the public health model is about trying to prevent disease on the front end, because what we want is a healthy population. We're not actually looking to punish people on the back end. I would say in the computer security area, what we've had to date has been an over-focus on the deterrence aspect and very little attention paid to prevention, detection, containment, and recovery. And given that we know there are always going to be adversaries, those adversaries are highly motivated, those adversaries are very good at hiding, they tend to be difficult to identify and jurisdictionally often out of the reach of our laws, it makes sense to try to figure out what we can do in the front end to make us all more secure. So what are the goals of public health law, which is what we ended up looking at? So the mission of public health, fulfilling society's interest in assuring conditions in which people can be healthy, and this other thing, to generate organized community effort to address the public interest in health by applying scientific and technical knowledge to prevent disease and promote health. I think in recent rhetoric around cybersecurity, you're seeing a similar change in the orientation of what the goal is, right? The goal is not necessarily to get the bad guy. It's an acknowledgement that cybersecurity, cyberspace, the internet, different terms are used, is a strategic national asset. Right, and part of this is motivated by the fact that we're looking at things like demand response energy, and we're looking at health IT, and we're thinking about the ways in which what is the backbone of the internet might actually play out to be, for example, the control that you're using. If we think about a web-based interface that's the TiVo for your home that you use to control the energy consumption, right? That it may be that, yes, we have the SCADA network for the energies and the utilities, but it may actually be that there's some interaction with the web, right? That there's a web interface, a web front end for this. And so the internet is being perceived as much more as a strategic national asset. There's this rhetoric now about these networks making sure that they're not just secure, but they're trustworthy and resilient, right? It's not just a computer security CIA version of security. We're interested in a more kind of humanistic version of security that means that these systems can be trusted to do the things that we want to rely on them to do, and that they're resilient, not just safe. And President Obama started using words like to deter, prevent, detect, and defend against attacks, right? Not just punish the bad guys, but to actually figure out how we engage in these preventative strategies. And I'd say for the first time, a much more specific focus on recovery, which is something that's been very underplayed in policy and law. So what about the reorientation in that rhetoric? How does that relate to kind of reorientations in the computer security literature? Well, the Trust in Cyberspace report, which Fred Schneider was the lead editor on, I believe, or lead author, I think is the right term, sorry, basically called for the community to revisit the paradigm of absolute security, right? It said, yes, we want to use technology and sound practices to reduce vulnerabilities, right, that introduce insecurity, right? So yeah, it would be good to use type-safe coding, type-safe codes, languages for coding, and it would be good to figure out what other kinds of practices, make sure that we catch all the buffer overruns and we do fuzz testing, et cetera. However, with respect to inherent insecurity, right, which is the security that comes from having all these component parts that are going to interact in unpredictable ways, and users who, despite what you put in the EULA, are going to do what they want with your software, that we have to move towards this model built on three axioms: that insecurity exists, it can't be destroyed, and it can be moved around. And that we have to think more broadly about how we do those things and not just focus on building a better mousetrap. This is taken up also in the Clean Slate Design for the Next Generation Secure Internet, which Steve Belevin wrote. And again, move away from a fixation on building secure systems to a more nuanced understanding of the security design space that allows trade-offs among a range of dimensions, including prevention, detection, recovery, resilience, and deterrence. You know, it may be the fact that when I lose an asset, lose, quote-unquote, somebody's compromised my machine, what I really want is the ability to still use that asset. I don't care that somebody else has it, right? So it may be that recovery is actually the best security in that context, and thinking a little bit more rigorously about what the actual risk is to an asset. Is it the downtime? Is it the loss of the asset? Is it the inability to access the asset? Really shapes the kind of mechanisms that you might use to deliver quote-unquote security. So what would this mean for a policy reorientation? Well, if we want to build on this insight from computer security and to deal with this inherent insecurity, I think that this idea of organizing community effort, which is in the public health legal framework, is really an important thing to consider, right? We are going to revisit this dominant legal focus on the bad guy. Certainly, we still want to punish bad people. Certainly, we want law enforcement to have resources. But we need to figure out how to address these individual actions that collectively contribute to our insecurity. And so that moves us away from this atomized view of security to a collective approach to managing insecurity. And this is what happened in public health. Public health didn't occur until there were technologies available to view until technology was available, and there was a political will, because there'd been enough outbreaks of disease that people understood were shared problems. And then we had this move from viewing health care, the individualized nature of health care, as the only thing that was necessary for public health. Because it turned out that your good hygiene wasn't necessarily going to protect you if you were interacting with everybody else. And so we started to realize that there were areas where we needed to take collective action. And that collective action wasn't necessarily something that we're all going to voluntarily engage in. And therefore that the state had a role in trying to figure out how to incentivize and in some instances coerce people to take actions that were necessary to prevent other people from the ill effects of their decisions because they were not going to be fully internalized. So prevention. And in the context of public health, here are some of the strategies that are deployed to create in the prevention area. We have very targeted regulations. There are conditions. So for example, if you want to send your kid to school, there's a certain set of vaccines they're going to have to get. Yes, there are some exceptions. However, the general rule is that there are conditions of participation. We subsidize the production of vaccines, we subsidize the distribution of vaccines, we subsidize the administration of vaccines, for one example. There are safe harbors in the context of manufacturing certain things that are important, but where the liability might be quite high. So again, you can look at vaccines. Companies that manufacture them, if they follow certain sets of practices, there's a regulatory structure that tests the batches and does spot inspections to make sure that the production facilities are sound. But at the end of the day, if you've done everything that you were supposed to as a manufacturer, and people get sick from the vaccine, and every year a certain percentage of kids do, we actually have a federal system that compensates people who have vaccine-related injuries. And it's because we wanted to make sure that vaccines are available. The liability exposure from vaccine problems, given that they usually manifest in kids who, before they got a vaccine, were healthy, is very, very high. And so the federal government stepped in to actually remove the liability threat that actually might undermine completely the availability of this really important mechanism for creating and maintaining public health. We also have public insurance, right? And the public insurance is important at an individual level because it gets individuals care, but it's also very important to us collectively, because if people don't get their diseases treated and they don't get their medications and their antibiotics, that affects all of us. So we have a whole host of different ways that range from direct regulations to incentives to subsidies to conditions that try to shape and manipulate the way in which individuals perceive their commitment to this shared endeavor of public health. So how might some of these translate into cybersecurity? Well, I mentioned just two slides ago, we certainly want to reduce vulnerabilities, right? There's some inherent vulnerabilities that are part of networks, and we're going to have to deal with those, but to the extent that we can, we certainly want to reduce vulnerabilities. So today, software developers and distributors generally disclaim liability for damages caused by their product beyond the purchase price, right? Some people have advocated that what we should do is establish tort liability remedies against vendors of insecure software. On the other hand, others have counseled against this because of the dependencies that complicate the ability to independently assess software vulnerabilities in isolation prior to deployment, as well as the dampening of innovation. Right? If we think about speed to market and we think about perfect security, to the extent that we're going to hold people liable for any security consequences of software, even if they're not particularly foreseeable, that would raise some really serious questions about the extent to which we had innovation. So one thing that we can look at is whether or not there are standards that we could use in development that, while they might not promise perfect security, because nothing will, are there mechanisms that we might agree upon that might move us towards software that's more likely to be to have fewer vulnerabilities? And I mentioned that the talk earlier this morning was about some of the processes that have been developed, whether it's the Microsoft security SDLs or others that have been put out that people are beginning to gain some traction about how we go about developing processes within businesses to develop more secure software. On the legal side, there's been some developments. The Federal Trade Commission has been relatively active, looking particularly where personal information is involved, looking at the extent to which companies that have been entrusted with people's personal information have put in place reasonable security practices to keep that information secure. So what does a reasonable security practice mean from the perspective of a regulator? Well, one of the most important components of it is that if you are using technology and there are known vulnerabilities, it requires that to the extent that there are mitigations available in the marketplace that you're using them, right? So it's this attention to the vulnerabilities that are in your system and the potential mitigations that are available. So forcing at least people to kind of stay up to date with patches, to be forward-looking, actually to do some threat modeling, to have reviews of their systems, to have somebody who's responsible for information security. I think all of these are steps in the right direction. I would say the SB 1386 or AB 700, the security breach notification laws, are another potential way to think about moving the marketplace, right? And this is not about setting a particular procedural or substantive standard. It's about trying to figure out whether or not there are some performance metrics that we should be thinking about achieving. Now, those performance metrics, they don't necessarily have to be a hard and fast line, right? Something like you can only have three vulnerabilities in your software, right? I don't know how we would come up with those. But merely by requiring the reporting of vulnerabilities, right, we begin to create something that is measurable that can force companies to pay increased attention to the vulnerabilities in the software that they create. Other areas that we can look at in the public health area, medical devices. It offers some interesting parallels to software. It's an area where the regulatory structure actually recognizes that there's some degree of risk inherent in the development of devices and that their introduction into the marketplace is not going to be risk-free, right? They understand that all the vulnerabilities in a medical device are not going to be able to be eliminated, and in part because each of us is unique, it's going to interact with the individual in different ways. The utility that we get out of constant innovation in the medical device marketplace is something that we want to maintain. And the device and its security, its ability, its both its performance and its risks, are in part going to be determined by the user and their skill. And so the regulatory structure that's set up by the Food and Drug Administration to administer for medical devices seeks to improve them and yet limit the risks through a set of both general manufacturing practices and processes, which you can imagine the FTC is starting to articulate something like that. I think things like the Microsoft SDL and other process-based agreements are starting to kind of push that up from the bottom. They also have inspections of facilities. They also have a clinical trial process that, again, relies on performance standards, not on substantive standards. And they have, I think most importantly, requirements for post-market surveillance of device performance and risk, as well as reporting. And why I think this post-market component is very important, I'll go back to voting technology again. Voting technologies are fielded. There's been no requirement in the regulatory apparatus that performance problems in the field feed back into the regulatory structure or feed back into the review of the systems. And that's really a lost opportunity to think about what sorts of processes could have been in place, what sorts of technical systems could have helped us identify the risks prior to deployment. And I think here too, as they do in the context of medical devices, having requirements that not only are vulnerabilities patched when they are found, but that there's a reporting and there's some notification and that system feeds back into our assessment of whether or not the processes that are put in place are meaningful to actually improve the quality of the software. I'm realizing that I'm using up a lot of time, so sorry. Reducing vulnerabilities. So developers are not the only folks who are responsible for the security of software and the choices that we make. And I'd say, one example of the importance of thinking about security throughout the life cycle, not just during the development phase, is something which Dan mentioned earlier, the Sony BMG CDs with rootkits in them, right? Here we, you know, it's a spectacular example of skewed incentives, right? So they decided to distribute this compact disk containing software that introduced rootkits and Trojans in the computers of millions of unsuspecting individuals. And they knew before they did it, right, that it had these features. But of course, the risk for them, they were very interested in protecting their asset, right? Their version of security was protect our intellectual property. They didn't care so much about the risks that protecting their intellectual property might pose for you or the rest of the network. And so how security is defined and how we allow people in the marketplace to push and externalize decisions that create insecurities for others because they're trying to improve their own security is another area where I think public health has something to tell us, potentially. And we can think about decisions about whether or not you send your kid to school, right? Sometimes you can't make those decisions because we've decided you might think your kid is healthy, but our assessment of your kid's health, your kid can't come back to school until they haven't had a fever for a day, right? And this is a rule, and it's not because you're not allowed to make decisions about your kid's health. It's that your decisions about your kid's health are not allowed to affect the decisions to affect the rest of our health, right? And so we make these calculations that might limit your own decisions about how you define health, for example, in an interest of protecting our collective health. Now, how that translates in a regulatory context in this space, I don't know. But we do know that Sony was able, under the current legal framework, to make some really bad decisions about how it defined security, right? It certainly, there was pushback on the back end. There were lawsuits, there were actions by the state AGs and the Federal Trade Commission, and those began to push from the bottom up, both some requirements about security processes. It also, in the context of Sony BMG, required that the state AGs actually required external review by computer security professionals of the decisions they made, right? So we get some check and oversight. So it's not just that a company gets to make that decision itself, but there was some external requirement. Now, this is a really interesting thing to think about. I can't imagine that anybody developing and deploying software is gonna be able to hire Ed Felton, for example, to do a review and to give them a check off, right? That really wouldn't seem manageable. But maybe there are some areas where there's really high risks, and it may be areas where one entity is seeking the opportunity to actually manage things on consumers' computers, right? Because this part of what happened here, this was about remote management of other people's machines, and that's an area where we know there's a lot of boundaries being transgressed, right? And so maybe there are certain areas where the ability for deployers of software, the decisions that they're making have some separate security concerns because of the risk that's posed by that remote management. And maybe that's an area where we could think about different sorts of structures. Okay, so we know no matter what we do on the front end, though, we're not going to get bug-free software. It's an elusive goal. We have this inherent insecurity caused by the fact that we're networked. We have these really motivated adversaries, and we all understand that we have to defend everywhere, attack anywhere. Defense in depth is good, but we're still left with the fact that there's a real resource problem here, which pushes us into this need to kind of reduce and mitigate vulnerabilities. The talk this morning, our opening talk from Google about Android, was very, very interesting. It was interesting to me, because he stood up here and he said, you know, I think that everybody should update automatically. He didn't quite say that should be legally required, but I kind of was waiting for him to say that. And what was interesting to me is that nobody asked him questions about that. I had to imagine somebody had a question. The Sony rootkit, just to harken, is a great example, right? They created an update, they created a patch that was worse than the initial problem, right? And so I don't know, automatic updates, a lot of you at least, like to make your own independent appraisal of whether or not the cure is actually a cure, right? Is that a feature or a bug? Is it an upgrade or a downgrade? However, we know right now that the failure to patch is a huge problem, and particularly because patches are often used as the blueprint for attacks, and that many of the most serious attacks we've had on federal systems, for example, have been DDoS attacks. That what they've done is exploited the fact that many people haven't updated their machines. They have vulnerabilities. They're exploited. They're then used to leverage and launch these huge denial of service attacks. And again, this is a perfect public health analogy where we have this problem of patch management and herd immunity, right? And there's a tipping point. If enough of us patch, right, it makes the attack that much less effective, and therefore people are going to look for something else. And right now, we know that many people don't patch. People don't patch after the vulnerability is first announced. There's a huge delay. There's a certain segment of the population that patches. I think initially everybody assumed it was probably people who were really taking a lot of time managing their machines. It turns out that's not always the case, because people in highly managed environments are most concerned about the disruption to the business processes that are caused by patching, right? And so what we often see is that when a vulnerability is announced, there's a big gap, and it's not until there's actually an exploit for the vulnerability announced that people patch. And in that time period, there's lots of potential exposure, and lots of machines are probably compromised. Now, you know, many individuals are probably not acting irrationally, right? When they patch their machine, they're not really sure how it's going to work. And I'm talking about the, you know, the consumer market. They're not sure how it's going to work. They don't want to turn off their machine. They don't want to reboot. They're not necessarily acting irrationally or malevolently. My guess is that most of them also have an underappreciation for the fact that their failure to patch leads to some DDoS attack on DHS, right? That they're just not getting that. And so we have this, you know, serious problem where the incentive for individuals to act in a way that would generate better security, keep us less, make us less insecure, is relatively low. And many people actually don't know either when their machine is compromised, right? So we do have these intermediaries, right? And one question has been, are there ways that we can incentivize ISPs to actually play some role here, helping people identify that their machine has been compromised, helping them fix the machine? Now, if you talk to ISPs, right, one help call blows their whole budget for the month, so they're not really looking to jump into this field. Many of these, many of the vulnerabilities and the compromises can be detected remotely, right? If they can be operated remotely, they can also be detected remotely. And so there's clearly a role here, and the question is, you know, one can think about interventions here in lots of different ways. One is, you know, so you want to have your automatic update off, that's fine, but you have to pay 10 extra dollars to your ISP so that when your machine comes compromised and they need to help you and they need to help other people because you're part of the problem, there's some pot of money to do that, right? One could imagine a really low-level intervention. One could also imagine an intervention that's more focused on providing resources for education. As I said, I think there's a large segment of the marketplace that they don't know they're part of the problem, right? And it may be that a more targeted intervention, a lower level intervention, could be the same way we've decided that the H1N1 virus, that what people really need to do is wash their hands and stop going to the hospital, right? People really need to be given the message that patching is a key thing for them to do. And this is, and if they don't patch, here are the kinds of consequences. It's not just that they're going to need a new machine or they're going to lose their personal information. It's that they are a national security problem. It doesn't mean that all cybersecurity problems need national security responses, right? Because some of them need kind of education hygiene responses. But it is really important to help people make that loop, that their activity can affect the collective good. Containment. Right now, if you are an ISP and you decide that there's some machines that are unpatched and they are being used as part of a DDoS attack. What do you do? Right? You start cutting off your users and they're not really happy with you and they start complaining and then they want you to help them, and right, it creates this whole cycle. And so one other question is, you know, what kinds of incentives could be put in place so that ISPs were willing to play that role? If they were willing to play that role, what kinds of rules and guidelines would you want to have about on what conditions are people's network activity cut off, or how is their network access reduced, under what kinds of circumstances? This is something that's come up if you think about the real-time black hole list, or you think about the Anti-Spyware Coalition, which you may or may not know about, but these are private sector initiatives that were brought about to try to get people to engage in good practices, but which initially lacked a lot of kind of due process protections, right? Paul Vixie decided you had a port open that you shouldn't, and therefore you're on the real-time black hole list and nobody's gonna accept mail from you, right? And, well, what do you do to get off the list? And is that a fair way to do this? And so, you know, there's a lot of policy thinking that has to go into thinking about a containment strategy. Yet, if we understand that we're able to identify compromised machines and that we could limit and mitigate the effects of those compromises in real time, it seems that one ought to be thinking about whether or not ISPs are the right place to do that or someplace else. And if they are, what kinds of rules and processes you'd want to put in place to think about under what circumstances is that appropriate? I'm going to skip configuration management just in the interest of time. I do want to talk just briefly about diversity, that just, you know, because there's a fair amount in the computer science literature about diversity. And again, right, this is a nice map onto public health. Diversity occurs naturally in the human population. Diseases evolve with different populations, and natural diversity provides lots of barriers to the spreads of disease. As everyone knows, there are many areas in computer, in cybersecurity, but we can also look at mobile platforms, where we have relative monopolies. And therefore we have monocultures, and where we have very different risks presented by those monocultures. Introducing diversity is really interesting, right? Dan Geer, several years ago now, talked about the risks of a monoculture, and I think had a rather, you know, kind of blunt instrument, you know, at least one, is just, you know, saying that we can't have over 50%, for example, of machines running the same operating system, right? There's a really blunt way to say that we need some diversity because we want to. And there are other ways to think about diversity, right? We can introduce diversity in lots of different places. Diversity doesn't necessarily have to rely upon kind of the more than one brand of operating system. We can also think about building diversity in during when things are compiled, right? There are different ways to think about introducing diversity into an ecosystem. Right now, there's not a lot of incentive, right? Certainly in the law, there's no incentive for building more diverse systems. We know that there is some indication in the marketplace, everything from, you know, very simple randomizing of domain name. Domain names? Help me. What? Thank you. Randomization of address space, right? And so there are other lighter ways to do this, and there are some natural leverage points to think about pushing for more diversity. But clearly, diversity is one way that we can at least raise the cost of exploitation and therefore provide, do something to address kind of the inherent security that we have to live with. I think this will be the last one I want to talk about. So detection. I've spent a fair amount of time with Vern and others thinking about the role of research in particular in helping to improve security, and the fact that often you can't really understand security problems when you have this very siloed view of what they are, that you need a broader picture. You need data from lots of different places. You need data over different times. And public health suffers from certain from a very similar set of problems, right? If you're a single physician in your office, a disease outbreak might not look like a disease outbreak. It looks like one patient throwing up, right? And so there are different ways in which public health deals with this. It's not all about surveillance, although some of it is. We have things like syndromic surveillance, which really were amped up after the anthrax attacks, where we're actually looking at otherwise not particularly interesting symptoms of people being admitted to hospitals, but when you look at them broadly, you might deduce a pattern that was significant. More typically, what we rely on are mandatory reporting laws, where there are certain sorts of diseases, communicable diseases, where as an individual provider or as a hospital, you're required to report these so that we're able to keep track of what's happening and we can identify outbreaks, et cetera. And again, part of this is because there's a real difference from looking at the trees and looking at the forest, and that often looking at things in a very localized way isn't going to give us the information we need to do research about what's causing diseases or what's causing security problems, right? And so we need more of a forest view. But it's also true that even when we know what it is that we're dealing with, we want to be able to understand how it's spreading and how it's propagating, and that looking in these very siloed views doesn't give us enough information to engage in mitigation and prevention techniques because we can't figure out how something is moving. And so I just want to, you know, highlight that there's some interesting ways in which the public health framework looks at reporting versus surveillance, and also looks at you know, what is an anomaly, right? It's certainly a problem when a bit is a bit, and an attack, right? One of my favorite stories, I got a call long ago when I was doing some advocacy work from the New York Times because they thought I was launching a denial of service attack on them, and I was like, no, those are your customers complaining. Right? It looked like a denial of service type because it was all coming from one site because it was an advocacy campaign because they were using double-click cookies. And they were like, that's a denial of service attack. And I was like, please, sue me. Right? And so you have some similar issues here. You know, what is an anomaly and how do you separate these things out? And there's a lot to learn both from the science on the public health side, but I think also from the legal interventions. Okay. So just in the interest of time, what did I want to talk about? So I just want to talk about some of the reasons that, close with some of the reasons that I think there are benefits to thinking about law. I've been involved in some of the conversations about the next generation internet and how do we build security and privacy into networks, and I think those are all really important and good. Right? Technology has values. They're not always the values we think it has, but definitely architecture is going to regulate in a really meaningful and important way. However, it also regulates in a way that might not translate very well in a global environment. Right? Another area where I do a lot of work is human rights. And if we think about the leakiness of the current architecture, that leakiness may be really bad in certain circumstances, and that leakiness might be really attractive in other circumstances. And one of the things about architecture and technical standards is that usually they have more than domestic reach, right? And so that the architecture that might be really well put in place here because we have, or we're returning to, a rule of law, open and transparent democratic processes, court systems that function, kind of a belief that people shouldn't be punished for their religious and political views, that speech is something that's valued, violence maybe not, but you can get really close with speech, right? That other countries might not necessarily have that same set of commitments, nor might they have the same set of legal and policy institutions put in place. When you think about exporting an architecture that is going to harden identification, right, binding individuals and machines really tightly, or limiting the capacity for people, to be anonymous, or to obfuscate, you have to think about how that's going to play out in different political regimes because architectures often cross boundaries more quickly than laws. One of the benefits of thinking about law and thinking about how law can contribute to reducing our cyber insecurity is that it takes some of the pressure off architecture. And I think there are really good reasons to take some of the pressure off architecture, because I think that we may end up with security in a very tight computer security, but not necessarily the kind of security that's needed to promote the free and democratic societies that we're trying to push throughout other parts of the world if we get really tight binding, for example, of identity and machine. There's also the fact that the political system, when it's operating well, is transparent and participatory and accountable and contestable. Right? This is the place where we play out these questions about how we balance privacy and security. And what security really means. Is it security of intellectual property, or is it security of the network, right? And technical standards are not normally known for their broad participation by all segments of the community, right? I've gone to technical standards setting in many, many different venues, IETF, OASIS, W3C, right? But there aren't a lot of other people from quote-unquote civil society, right, who are there to kind of think about the value implications of technical choices. And so I think that there's a real question about the handoff between how much we want to embed in technology and how much we want to think about using the law, which in some ways is actually a more flexible tool than technical standards, to think about improvements in cybersecurity. Because they can be more domestic, they can be more flexible, they can relate not just to the technical capacity, but also to the legal and institutional support we have that balances and mediates between different versions of security. So the last thing I wanted to say is just, this is really a key time for researchers. I kind of gave you a little overview of some of the ways in which I think the public health legal framework might help us think about different sorts of legal tools to motivate cybersecurity, better security practices. But my kind of litany of here are some options is still a litany, because choosing among these various interventions really requires more information and more research. Why is it that people don't patch? Is it because, as I suggested, they don't understand that their decision not to patch has these really serious implications? Is it that they're totally opposed to patching over their dead body, right? What is it? Because unless I know more about what the barrier is, it's hard to figure out what the littlest, smallest legal intervention could be into the marketplace to jigger this. And as somebody who's, I'm a lawyer, so I like the law a little bit, but I like to use the kind of tiniest nudge I can. And in order to figure out what the right nudge is, you want to really understand the problem. I'll give you one little example where, why understanding the problem can really matter. We mentioned the security breach notification law quite a few times. So one of the interesting things about that is that there's this out. If you've encrypted the data, you don't have to notify people that you've had a breach. So on the positive side, that means that people have encrypted data. On the negative side, it means that where there are breaches, but the data was encrypted, we don't get any information about the kinds of vulnerabilities that are leading to compromise. And that means there's less information about the kinds of things that we should be looking at reducing, right? So it actually reduces the information in the marketplace that might help us better focus our security resources, right? So that's a bit of a trade-off that I really didn't appreciate. Another example is that because the notification law is only requires reporting where the vulnerability that's been exploited has led to a breach of personal information, it means that the CEO is now all over the CISO about protecting personal information. And perhaps stealing resources from other areas of security that might actually be more important if we think about the security of the network. Right? Because now all of a sudden, if I'm going to lose face if there are breaches of personal information, but if there's a breach that lets our machine gets compromised and we're part, with 3,000, 3 million, pick your number, other machines of a DDoS attack, there's not going to be any front page Washington Post story about that, right? And so you want to think about these interventions and the unintended consequences of them, and therefore kind of more research to figure out how you tailor them is really important. And then finally, knowledge transfer, not just tech transfer. I mentioned the demise of OTA in the beginning, and there's also been kind of a fragmentation of funding around cybersecurity, and there's been much more of a focus on short-term research rather than long-term research. And despite the fact that the administration has said we're going to have, you know, a champion for cybersecurity, et cetera, right now there's still an ongoing gap in leadership and a lack of clear positive agenda on the policy side, for sure. And what I'd like to behoove you all to do is to think about participating, right? There are people in this room, Susan Landau, for example, and Ed Felton and Steve Belevin, who've been very, very active in participating in the sound development of public policy by making sure that people understand the science, right? If you're going to regulate crypto and you're going to demand back doors, here's the kind of insecurity you're going to create, right? That sort of making sure that there's a translation of what you do in your labs and what you do, what you write about, into policy circles to the extent that there's a cybersecurity agenda that's going to get set and it's going to have implications for the security of the networks, you're in a great position. I can't tell you that you have to, but I really would like to encourage you to think about how your research might contribute to answering some of these problems, right? If there are going to be new policies, if there are going to be new laws, if there are going to be new educational strategies, what do you know that might help us shape them? Because you're the people that are in the best position to provide information, and I know that the pipeline doesn't always seem very open, and I'm sure many of you are saying, well, I don't even know how I would get anybody to listen to me. But you can, and there are people in this room that can help you think about ways to translate, and I'm certainly happy to do that too. But there are open research questions. There are areas where people are developing policy without any information about the research that you have that might contribute to them making good decisions. And so one of the reasons I was really happy to be able to be here today was to encourage you to participate in the policy process, because we need you. So thank you.
I'm Jelena Mirkovic from USCISI. I have one response to your talk and then two remarks and a question. So the response why people don't patch, personally for me, it's a lot of overhead to reboot every time when I patch. So it's either rebooting the computer or rebooting the application or clogging my network because now there's this big download that has to happen when I want to use my network or something else. So I think it's more of a technological problem than a legal problem. You could force me to patch every time that there's a new update, but it actually would be better if patching were seamless. Two remarks. You talked about two topics that actually got mentioned in yesterday's CSET workshop, cybersecurity experimentation and test, and I would encourage people to go online and look at those papers and the discussion. One is that we have levels and flavors of security. So it's not just that there's this generic notion of security, but there is confidentiality, integrity, reliability, how quickly I can recover, and different things are important to different people, and we really need to be more specific, and that's an excellent notion that got mentioned yesterday in the panel. Panel slides are on my webpage, and I'll get Usenix to post them on the CSET page too. The other notion, the relation to public health, I think it's an excellent parallel that public health relates to security. That also was the focus of part of the CSET, and there was a paper about clinical trials, whether we can use something like clinical trials to evaluate security solutions. There are a lot of problems there, but it's also a great idea to be explored, and I think that's something to worth thinking about. The question I have for you, and actually what I think is lacking in your talk, it's very difficult to enforce something that cannot be measured. Metrics and evaluation methods for security are an ongoing problem. So how can I enforce someone to deploy certain type of defense when I cannot guarantee that this defense works, how well it works. I cannot even measure if I'm infected or if I'm not infected. I can prove it to someone else. I mean, I can in specific situations, but there's a lot of cases where it's difficult to measure and the community doesn't agree what's the right approach. So can you talk about legal framework and how it relates to lack of measurement?
Yeah, so, you know, I talked a little bit about standards, and I could give you a whole talk about standards, but one of the reasons that I think the performance standards are actually kind of the most promising in this area is because they avoid all those problems. They don't tell anybody what to do. They don't tell you what technology to use, right? They basically say, look, here's a goal, and the goal can be stated as an affirmative or a negative. Right? It can be, you know, you have to achieve X. You have to show that your technology addresses these 15 threats. Right? Here are the threat models. Show that you've addressed these threat models in your design. Right? So that could be a performance standard. It could also be, as I said, a negative performance standard, which is not only do we not tell you what to do, what we want you to do is where you fail to perform, you need to tell us. Right? And that's the security breach model. And it's even kind of less overhead because it says you come up with your own threat models, right? I just want to know when you blow it, right? And so both of those are aimed at getting institutions to think in an ongoing, process-based, institutional, context-specific way. And they say, look, you know, you know more than I do about the threats that you face, about the adversaries, about the educational level of your employees, about the way in which your systems interoperate, your business processes. I'm not going to tell you what to do, right? And so I actually think that those sorts of performance standards are a far better way to think about standards in the security space. I still think that figuring out what the performance measure is, I'm not suggesting that's an easy question, right? And I would not suggest that the security breach notification laws have them have it right, right? I wouldn't say, but I think it's a better way because it provides far more flexibility and allows people who are in the best position to figure out how to mitigate to do that risk assessment.
Okay, so one small remark there. I believe that a lot of vulnerable machines out there are personal user machines rather than, you know, associated with an institution. So there your talk about standards and processes and you need to notify us when you have a breach really doesn't apply at all. So what do you do about those?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, my general sense is that, you know, a lot of what's going on is vulnerabilities in the consumer market that leads, right, that contribute to DDoS attacks and other forms of vulnerability. And there, I'm not certain. Part of me thinks that there's an educational component for sure. But I also think that we need to really seriously think about things such as automatic updating. And you know, but part of it requires us to, right, we have this intuition that this is really where at least one source of the problem is. You need to figure out, right, really understand the demographics of this particular group, right? Is it all people like my parents who literally unplug their computer, right, because they're afraid things are going to happen, right? They unplug it. I spent a whole week with them explaining that, you know, if we turn off the computer, it'll be okay, and it's okay if the wireless router is on. It's not going to, right? And so it may be a lot of those sorts of people who need to understand patch management, need to be encouraged or required to put it on by default. You know, maybe you sell different versions of an operating system, and the ones that have automatic update automatically on are cheaper. Mm-hmm. I don't know, right? I can think about lots of different ways, but part of it requires some more research to really figure out what the barriers are.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, Deirdre.
Hi.
Dave Crystal.
How are you?
Fine. It's been a while. I have some comments and then some more comments.
And I'm expecting that people have comments, objections. I'm expecting hate mail. It's all okay.
With regard to patching, I think one problem is that probably a lot of us in the room are thinking in terms of that everybody has broadband and that patches are cheap to download, and there are quite a few people for whom that's not true. I was thinking about the individual versus business distinction, and I focusing on people rather than businesses, I was thinking of a couple of analogies. One is driving. Suppose that people had to be licensed to use computers, had to have some minimal level of experience and ability and understanding, and that their computers themselves had to be inspected in the same sense that cars get inspected every year or two. Another analogy that came to mind was not necessarily a good one. In the old days when AT&T held sway over which devices you could connect to the network and have some way, it's almost like the inspection analogy, have some way of determining when a machine is safe to connect, safe for the rest of us, for them to connect to the machine, to the network. And a final thought was, how do we address these problems outside U.S. jurisdiction, where, you know, China, South Korea, Taiwan have huge numbers of computers, and it's believed that many of them are compromised, and we have no control over them.
Yeah. I'm not going to try to take on all of those. The one I will pick out of that bunch is the analogy to kind of AT&T interconnection. You know, can you connect any device you want? And you know, at the end of the day, the law there said you can, as long as it doesn't kind of damage the rest of the network. Right, and so generally, you know, we have a pretty liberal laissez-faire culture, which says you're entitled to do any kind of horrible thing to your body, as long as you're not hurting everybody else. And how we draw that line is quite complicated. But I think there is a need to try to figure out whether there are places that cross that line because of the need to figure out how to do prevention, not just deterrence work. And I think it's really complicated. I don't think it's as complicated as, you know, forcing medical treatment upon somebody, right? Which is far more complicated. But I think, you know, people are pretty tied to their ability to use their general purpose computing platform to do whatever they want and to run whatever they want in whatever state of disarray they like. And beginning to say, well, do you know what? You could do that, but just don't hook it up to the network, right? We're going to contain you in your home. And you know, I didn't get into all of the different ways in which public health, but you know that there's shielding versus containment, and there's home, there's isolation versus quarantine. There are a whole bunch of different kind of flavors of ways in which you can go about sandboxing. Right? And I think that some of those are likely far more tolerable than others, but all of them require us to figure out, you know, what is too much harm.
Thanks.
My question is about a situation where an organization, let's say a large organization, has been significantly compromised by some bot activity and they're engaged in some nefarious attack or something on someone else. And the incursion is subsequently discovered. Has there been any recent precedents or jurisprudence opinion about the liability of that organization for the actions of the bots on their computers if that company is not actively monitoring their traffic or watching for that type of activity?
Okay, so the company who was attacked?
The company had been infested with a bot network. So many of their computers are now bots, and they are involved in some type of nefarious activity being carried out by the bots from their computers. Is there any recent precedents where the company is then liable for the action of those bots coming from their computers if they're not actively monitoring their I've read some papers out of, I think, the University of Illinois that predicted that there would be a liability in the company. I'm not sure if it's been tested in the courts yet.
Yeah, I don't know of any decision finding liability, but I know there's at least one, I don't even know if it's been filed, but there's at least one instance like that. Something that's kind of parallel is in the context of the security breach notification laws, there's been litigation between the credit card grantors And the folks who have the transaction, that carry the transactions between the retailers and the retailers, right? All these people fighting out who has to bear the cost of the notifications and reissuing the cards, et cetera. And there's a similarity because a lot of times it's about, you know, well, you created this massive insecurity that then created all this risk for me, and how do you shift the liability? And there's both case law dealing with that, and there's also some state statutes that have been trying to apportion liability in ways that are unlikely to end up with the people who are in the best position to avoid the problem cheaply, unfortunately. I don't think they're doing a good job, but that's the most relevant case law.
Hi, Marcel Simon from Mecco Health Solutions. And by the way, as a testimonial, I can tell you the 1386 law had absolutely profound impact on information management at my company. We hold personal information for about, 60 to 100 million people. So thank you.
You're welcome. Well, thank Senator Simidian, actually, and Senator Peace. There's an idea to a law. There's a lot that happens in between there.
As a question, public health model implies accepting a certain background level of disease. I mean, you're not going to close a school because a couple
That's
of kids
right.
have a cold, right?
Yeah.
So how does that translate to cybersecurity, and what is a background level that we might be willing to accept?
Yeah. Well, that's a political question, of course, and so I can't give you an answer, a straight answer on what the number, like, right? But I think the mapping is direct because it's all about risk management, right? If all of us decided to stay home, wear gloves and masks all the time, right, we could really reduce our level of disease. Mm-hmm. We could close all the borders, right? We can do, but there's a cost benefit, and we like the free flow of information just like we like the free flow of people. I don't know, one, I don't think it's a fixed amount. You know, our tolerance for risk and open borders mm-hmm. has shifted dramatically depending upon other things that are happening in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, recently you've seen pretty big shifts in the federal government's opinions about their tolerance for risk. So things like the trusted internet connection and Einstein and programs that they're deploying suggest that their calculations about the cost benefit of openness and reliability and security is changing, and it's a political question, and I think it should be thought of as a political question.
Yeah, I'm thinking, I mean, to the gentleman's point, if there is one machine on my network that gets infected and attacks, somebody else's network, they're probably not going to come after me, but if it's 10, they might start thinking about it. If it's 100, they'll probably, so it's that kind of understanding of, so that, we can tune our own program sort of a thing. So,
yep.
And that would be it. So any kind of guidance or further research on that would be very appreciated. Thank you.
My question is about tort law. So it has been applied in engineering for about 100 years. And in engineering, they also have innovation. So I think innovation counter-argument is kind of questionable. So what exactly the kind of rhetoric in the law community about whether tort law should be applied to computing software systems?
I couldn't hear all your question. I thought I heard you say that you'd been an engineer for 100 years, and I know I shouldn't say
no,
that.
The law was applied in engineering for engineering contracts and systems for
uh-huh.
about 100 years.
And so your question being, why isn't tort law the right mechanism in the context of software vulnerabilities?
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is there's much to say here, but tort law, maybe, can you and I talk after? Can we talk, because it's a longer conversation, but the general issue is that the way in which law in the U.S. has evolved around software is very far from a tort framework. The question about, there's a political question about whether or not you'd be able to get the law back in that direction, and I would tell you my calculation is kind of straight up tort liability for security failures of software is highly, highly unlikely to come out of the court system, right? So just at a you know, as a, is that going to be a mechanism that works? I don't think so. There's some arguments being made that if you look at like the context of Sony rootkit, right, where there's an intentional distribution of a vulnerability, right? It's not just that there's a vulnerability in your software. It's that, you know, they were intentionally disclosing, they were intentionally putting something in the marketplace that created a vulnerability in their, in your machine to help them protect their interests. And so kind of the putting into the marketplace software that has serious vulnerabilities that are going to create risks to individuals, I think that there's some hope that there might be some law there. I think it is more likely to come out of consumer protection law, out of the Federal Trade Commission and the state AGs, than out of straight tort law. And that's something we can talk about offline. But part of it is just that they've developed in very different ways.
I think using the idea of public health as a model for cybersecurity law is very interesting, because there have been a lot of analogies so far between, and a lot of looking at now, we have our digital security problems related to epidemiological scenarios.
Yeah.
However, the one, I think one interesting problem that arises from this, or at least two based on this talk, the first being diversity, in that diversity in the biological world helps greatly to prevent viruses, as does in the technological world, but the usefulness of our technologies depends on these network effects and the fact that the more people using a piece of software, the more useful it is. And so I think we run into some problems there with diversity, and that a lot of companies then don't like their software interoperating with other software in which we could have this diversity coexist. The other one, I think we all sort of like this idea at some level of, man, it'd be kind of nice if everybody was forced to patch. But the big problem being, in the terms of vaccines, we have something such as the FDA that can perform some studies, make sure they're relatively safe, that there's very minor problems. And we wouldn't exactly have that with patches, or at least something that doesn't work quick enough. So I don't know if you've thought there should be some sort of government organization or some sort of regulating body that would then have to test these patches, or how would we go about regulating their safety before releasing them and still doing this all in a timely manner?
Yeah. So one of the things that most interested me about the talk this morning about Android was I think what he suggested, you can correct me if you think I'm remembering wrong, was not only, you know, should, as a operating system developer, should I have an automatic update for my stuff, but I should also supply one for all the applications that run on my system. And so on the one hand, I think if you're looking at someone like Google or Microsoft, that when they deploy a patch that makes something worse off than it was, the market's going to respond. Now, are people going to be able to vote with their feet? No, there's huge sunk costs, right? There's lots of reasons to think that people are not going to be able to vote with their feet, but there will be other sorts of damage that I think suggest that they're going to vet their patches. They're going to like do due diligence on their patches before they deploy them. I think that some of those assumptions fall away. The smaller the application is, the less public the company is. I think there's a whole host of issues there. And that's why, you know, I'm sorry that I can't remember the man's name from this morning. Richard, thank you. When he did his presentation, I was actually surprised that people didn't push back on that auto update. And particularly, like, if I were Google or Microsoft, I wouldn't want to be pushing down updates for other people's programs, mm-hmm. right? I would want to be doing some kind of checking on them, or I'd want some certainty that they'd done some sort of due diligence, or right? And so, yeah, it's a complicated area, but if we're not going to, it would be difficult to imagine that you're not going to have any sort of review of the initial program, but you're going to have a review of the updates. I mean, mm-hmm. and I don't imagine having federal oversight over software generally. It sounds like a bad idea to me. So,
thanks.
You're welcome.
So when you were talking about in the ISP area and identifying, you're doing a lot of comparison to public health, you said, if we've made the decision as a society that automatic updates are going to be for the benefit of the society's health. You said you can pay $10 and opt out to pay for the cost of support, because obviously if you don't have the patches, you're more likely to have support. But isn't that the opposite of a preventive health in, you know, if you're looking in general health, as saying, I can pay $20 a month and I can eat all the cheeseburgers and I can smoke all the cigarettes I want. So wouldn't it be much better to build, the cost should be built in either. It should be, you should have a certain amount of hours per month of care you can get from the provider, and they should have to raise the cost, and it's like insurance. You have to pay in for all the other idiots out there, even if you are doing the right thing. And you should maybe get a discount. If you have automatic updates, you get some kind of reimbursement. But if you give people the option to opt out, and it's cheap enough, it's a cheap enough decision, they're going to always opt out, and they're going to be insecure. And later on, that produces greater costs for the rest of society. Because now if I just have a valid problem, I have automatic updates, I should have the same right to get support from the ISP. I shouldn't have to wait for all these people to do automatic updates to get support back. So it doesn't... It seemed a bit a little contrasting with some of the other points.
Yeah, I was just trying to set out, I mean, there are a whole host of different ways that we could think about altering the incentives in that space, and that's just one, right? And you are absolutely right. One of the things that's happened, most states, well, every state has an exception to the mandatory vaccination laws where it's going to harm the child's health, right? So I have some nephews who have a very horrible disease. Those kids actually do get vaccinations, but they could choose to opt out because the risk to their health is actually, you know, it's a borderline call. And so they're allowed to ride on everybody else's immunity and not themselves have the risk of getting the vaccine because of the potential, right? A lot of states have more recently, some have had them for a long time, but there's been a more recent introduction of exceptions for religious reasons, personal objections, et cetera. And there are whole enclaves of communities that are accepting themselves and suffering outbreaks of things like measles, right? And as you said, the cost is too low. They have to fill out a form, right? They don't. There's not a lot of deterrent. And so there are, you know, real trade-offs here that I think you want to consider. And part of it, I think, is where you think the tipping point is, right? And it may be that we can tolerate a certain number of people opting not to do it and still have enough coverage to make certain sorts of attacks not economical. And it may be that the tipping point is so high that you don't want to let people opt out at all, right?
Right. But would an insurance-type system be like? Would that be an improvement, or would that be a disadvantage to say everyone has to pay, everyone in the country has to pay $5 a month to combat computer security problems when they come up?
We have to take this off.